Welcome to Adaptive Signal Processing. My name is Joe Piccone. I'm a professor here at Mississippi State University, and I'll be the instructor for this course. You should have received some email from me over the past few days. The syllabus has been posted, as have the first lecture notes. And I would encourage you to to read the syllabus, of course. You know, I hate to interrupt, but I'm thinking that a lot of the other students are probably still looking for this course in CIMRAL 250. I sent an email last night telling them the room was changed to 106, but that wasn't posted on their schedule. So they're probably sitting up there wondering where I am. Okay, so a little bit of logistical issues here. I think we should have three students at the remote site during this course. They call in or something like that? They can call in to get audio? Is that? I think they should be sitting in it. But anyway, if the students are out there, feel free to call in. However you do that, just say hello. If you're hearing this at a tape delay, just call me on my office phone or something, and we can deal with that. Okay, so some of our students are coming in. Good morning. Sorry, I sent email last night about the change in the room, but looks like you haven't read that yet. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. What I'd like to, unless there are any questions, what I'd like to do today is to essentially go through chapter one. It's always good to cover one chapter each day, right? So chapter one in the textbook is a review chapter. It essentially walks through a lot of different topics in digital signal processing and statistical signal processing and various related fields. So I wanted to sort of go through that fairly quickly today just to give you an idea of the type of material that I'll expect you to have some background in for this course. I've listed the textbook on the syllabus as reference because it's my feeling that the textbook is rather dated. There's not a really good contemporary textbook in this adaptive filtering. So what I would like to do this semester is to spend about the first half of the semester going through some of the key topics in the textbook and then spend the second half going through contemporary topics in adaptation, since there has been a lot of significant work in the last 5 to 10 years. And the textbook was published, I think, 1993 or something. So it's fairly dated. So if you don't want to buy the textbook, I'm fine with that. I'll give you fairly detailed notes from the textbook. And like I said, we'll spend about half the class on it. It is, however, when it was published, it was one of the more popular texts in this area because there aren't a whole lot of textbooks in this area. So to begin, you'll notice the notes are online, and this will be the format for the notes. At the beginning of each lecture, I'll put up the objectives for that lecture. These are the key points I hope that you'll remember. I'll probably ask you at the beginning of each class what the key points were from the last class. I hope you'll not simply read these, but you'll actually paraphrase these and provide a little bit of insight. I will also provide links to some internet resources related to the lecture material. Those of you who know I like to work off the internet quite a bit, and with almost any topic in signal processing these days, there's a wealth of information available on the internet. I like, as many of you know, I like Wikipedia. We'll point to there quite frequently. And in this particular case, I've also listed another course, a course taught at Stanford, which is a pretty good course, and some software resources. So each lecture, I'll try to provide you with some resources that give more expanded explanations of the class material. And then I'll throw in a couple pictures related to the topic of today's lecture. We'll talk a little bit more about this picture in a moment. One of the interesting things about a lot of fields in signal processing, a lot of aspects of signal processing, is that they find application to many, many areas beyond traditional electrical engineering. So here I've actually shown a picture of some time series analysis of financial data. Business and finance has been an area, a very popular area over the last 5 to 10 years for people to apply a lot of the concepts that we learn in signal processing. And adaptive signal processing is one of those, in that if you're trying to track stock market prices and predict stock market prices, you can obviously see the application for an algorithm that's able to keep sort of track changes in the signal and adapt to changes in world events and things like that. Let's see, actually, I think I can use this. How do I advance with the click? Is there, do I have to go to the terminal or is there a... Oh, there, down there, okay. Okay, great, great. Oh, okay, I'll just use the touch screen. Okay, great. Okay, thank you. So let's begin with some definitions. The textbook is titled Optimal and Adaptive Signal Processing. So we'll talk a little bit about what it means, what optimal signal processing means, and then about adaptive. The two areas are different. Optimal signal processing refers to the design, analysis, and implementation of processing systems that extract information from sample data in a manner that is best or optimal. That's sort of a circular definition. Optimal signal processing is optimal, is basically what that says. That's a quote from the textbook. But what this really means is, in the context of this course, is that in a statistical sense, we will try to maximize some criterion function. Now, later we'll see that this is typically what's called a posterior probability, and we'll do that maximization by adjusting some or all of the parameters of the model, or by introducing some additional parameters of the model. Popular methods to do this are minimum mean squared error. That's a technique that became very popular in the 1960s and 1970s. By the mid-80s, maximum likelihood techniques were very popular. By the early 90s, maximum a posteriori or MAP methods were popular. And over the last 10 years or so, Bayesian methods have become sort of dominant in almost any field of signal processing. And we'll talk about all these techniques in this course. Adaptive signal processing refers to the process of adjusting the parameters of a model as new data is encountered, again, to maximize a criterion function. So the differentiation between optimal signal processing and adaptive is, with adaptive, you're trying to change the system to reflect changes in the environment. So the way typically this will work is that you will train a system on a large bunch of data that you have access to. That's often called offline training. But then as you put the system into operation, something might happen, and you would like the system to be able to adapt to that. Key issues, as we'll see through this semester, associated with this are supervised versus unsupervised. Is the new data you're adapting to, is it truth marked so that you know the answer that your system should produce for this new data? Or are you doing this blindly? You don't really know what the classification of the new data is. This may seem a little strange, but if you think about the fact that how many times when you ask for help under Microsoft Windows, do they ask, was this help useful to you? Or when you go on to any kind of a search engine where they ask, was this information what you wanted after you issue a search? Well, that's actually a cute little way of producing supervised information. When you answer yes to that, then they're able to use that data as a way to adapt. And in fact, if you answer no, they can also sort of adapt to it as well. Another issue that we'll see is online or offline. Do you adapt to as new data arrives, or do you accumulate a set of new data and adapt based on this data and all previously encountered data? In some systems, they will run offline overnight. They'll take all the data that was processed for that day's transaction, and they will then recompute parameters based on that. That's often called batch mode re-estimation. In other cases, you will try to actually adapt in real time. In the cell phone space, that's very important. Can you, over a matter of a few seconds, adapt the models or your parameters to the particular cell phone that somebody's using? And a related issue then is fast versus slow. How much data do you need to adapt? Can you adapt in a matter of a few seconds worth of data, which is very important in transactions such as telephone-based transactions? Or do you need hours of data if some of you have used some of the early dictation systems on computers, they often ask you to spend about 20 minutes training them. And that's a longer-term form of adaptation. And a related question to that then becomes, if you have to worry about things like how fast, how much can you really rely on the new data? Is it representative of the problem space, or is some of it anomalous? So as you look through these issues, you will learn that, you will realize that there's a lot of overlap with the pattern recognition course. Some of the people in here took my pattern recognition course last semester, where we discussed a lot of these techniques in great detail. We'll try to minimize the amount of overlap between those two classes, but for those of you who don't have a background in pattern recognition, you may have to do a little bit more reading outside of class, because we won't be going into as much detail on these topics as we do in pattern recognition class. We'll focus more on application of these concepts to the problem of adaptation. Okay, I got to learn. I can do that. There we go. So let me begin then by talking a little bit about a couple applications or a couple environments that describe what adaptive signal processing is all about. Here is a rather high-level view of a system that does some form of biological system pattern recognition. Could be language, it could be image, it's sort of a general view of a lot of different types of systems that involve humans, human decision making. And what's shown here is a hierarchy from sort of at the top. You have a lot of information about the domain, materials, morphologies, ontologies, those kinds of things. And then as you move down the system, you move closer to the actual sensors, detectors, and rules that govern those. In such an environment, you will typically collect a lot of data and train some kind of classification system. But at some point, you want to put the system into a learning mode where, as it makes decisions, the user provides feedback whether the decisions are correct or not, and then the system adapts its parameters accordingly. Now, one of the great examples of this, of course, is humans. Humans are very much driven by the process of corrective or reinforcement learning or adaptation. Humans are always adapting their knowledge to the real world based on feedback. And what we're going to really study in this course is this process of how do you actually mathematically modify the parameters of your system based on this type of feedback. Now, adaptation is all about exploiting any kind of information that you have about the system. It's no longer about simple things like mean squared error. It's much more about things like ontologies or hierarchies that describe the problem space. For example, if you're dealing with a language processing system that monitors broadcast news, you want that system to be able to adapt to changes in the world events. So the Olympics started today. All sorts of information now on the internet about Olympics that wasn't there a couple weeks ago. Your system needs to be able to adapt to that, adapt to very high-level information such as the domain, the subject, those kinds of things. So that's a general view of what adaptive systems is all about. And whether we're processing electronic signals, text, any of these kinds of things, we can formulate this using a common set of statistical operators. And then that's really what we'll talk about this semester. An example, a slightly more detailed example, is shown here from a field I work in, speech recognition. And in speech recognition, that's an application where you try to take in an audio signal and produce the words that were spoken. Most of the systems suffer from really kind of two types of problems. First, they overtrain on the data. Typically, no matter how large your database is, even if it's many thousands of hours of speech, the system will overtrain. It will learn too much about that training data and will not generalize properly to the new data. Adaptation, therefore, is employed to allow systems to deliver high performance in previously unseen environments or for new speakers or microphones. So the system, when it encounters a new speaker, will often modify the parameters of its models to match that speaker. And the process of going from these general parameters to these very specific speaker parameters, we're going to talk a lot about that in the general sense this semester, because obviously you can go too far. You can model too closely a particular speaker. But most of the systems that you use today actually do some form of online adaptation. For example, if you've used dialogue systems over the telephone, they're actually figuring out, you know, what you're saying, how you're saying it, and they're adapting to you as you talk to the system. So that's a little bit of an overview of the types of things we will see we need a voice interface for that. Next slide, please. And don't, you can do that probably back there. Okay, so that's the high-level stuff, big vision, easy. Let's spend the rest of today very quickly going through a number of topics that are going to form the basis for this course. And these will be mostly topics from digital signal processing, random signals, random processing. So we can define a discrete random signal as a sequence x0, x1, x2, xn. This is essentially just a sequence of numbers, but from your DSP class, you know that this can be related back to an analog signal, then there's governed by the Nyquist sampling theorem and various things like that. But in this course, we're going to work primarily in the discrete domain, and we'll just be looking at the sequence and not worry so much about the analog equivalent of that signal. So what's random about this sequence is essentially the values x0, x1, x2. We're going to treat those as random variables. So the first thing you might ask is, well, how are those random variables distributed? And the general way that we look at that is first through a probability density function, which tells us something about the way the range that the amplitude takes and how it's distributed. With this, you're used to things like Gaussian random variables, uniformly distributed random variables, and things like that. A related concept is the cumulative density function, which is the integral of the probability density function. So you can talk about these two interchangeably because the density function is related to the cumulative function but simply by derivative. We can also talk about signals that are deterministic versus random. A deterministic signal is essentially a signal that is repeatable. Sine wave is a good example of a deterministic signal. If I tell you the amplitude, frequency, and phase of a sine wave, you know everything you need to know about that signal for all of time. Whereas if the signal is random, it cannot be predicted, it is not repeatable, and it can only be characterized through statistics. Oftentimes, we'll model signals actually as a sum of a deterministic component, such as a sine wave, and a random component, such as Gaussian white noise. In a lot of communication theory, this has been a very classical way of looking at things like modulation. You have a deterministic signal which you control and imposed on that various types of noises. So if we can only view the random signal through its statistics, what are some of the statistics that are useful to us in viewing those signals? Well, the first thing you'll talk about for a continuous random variable is the mean value, which can be defined as the expectation of the amplitudes x of n, and that can be found by integrating x of n times the density function over its range. So this is for a continuous random variable, but we can also compute this we can sort of approximate this as an ensemble average. We can take simply the values x, sum them up, divide by the number that we summed, and have an estimate of the mean. And the relationship between these two we'll talk about in a little more detail today, but oftentimes we don't actually know what the probability density function is, so we have to essentially estimate that from the data. How we actually estimate a mean from data, that's again a subject that is dealt with at great length in a pattern recognition course. It's a parameter estimation problem. But in this course, we'll simply refer to those results and show you useful ways to do that. Expectation operators are very popular because they're mathematically well-behaved. One very important characteristic that expectation operators have is they're linear. If you have the expectation of a linear combination of two signals, that's nothing more than the weighted values of the expectation of the individual signal. So the expectation of A times X plus B times X, A times X of N, M and B times X of N, this is just A times the average of X of M plus B times the average of, that should be X of N there. So expectation operators are linear, and that's a very desirable property of almost any transformation. Later, we'll see that expectation operators are also sufficient statistics and things like that. Another important property is that the expectation of a function of a random variable is given by simply the integral of that function weighting the probability density function. So again, this is sort of a nice linear transformation type property that if the output random variable y is some function of x, then its mean or expectation will also be the integral of that function times f of x. So another property you should be familiar with from your random processes background. All right, it's not going to like me this semester. There we go. The next thing we look at when we talk about random sort of modeling or viewing random variables is correlation. Correlation or covariance play a very important role in linear system theory because, again, you can decouple signal and noise using these types of operators. So the correlation of a random signal X of N can be defined by the expectation of X of M times X of N, and that's computed for a continuous random variable by integrating over the joint distribution between X of M and X of N. Now, with correlation and covariance, most of the time you're used to seeing this simply be a delayed version of this signal, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But in a more general sense, this is a definition of correlation. Now, once again, this can also be computed using an ensemble average. We can take the limit as n goes to infinity of the sum of xi of m times xi of n. And the relationship between these two is very important in signal processing because we don't often know the joint distribution of the data. We have to either approximate that somehow, and this turns out to be a very good way to compute the correlation when we don't know what the joint distribution actually is. The autocorrelation is defined as essentially a correlation with the signal in itself, so we can write that as the expectation of x squared of n. The covariance of a random signal is defined as how that signal deviates from its mean. So it's similar to a correlation, but we subtract the mean, so that we're essentially measuring the way that signal deviates from its mean. So the correlation of a signal is the expectation of that signal minus its mean times the other signal minus its mean. And if you have the joint distribution, you can compute that by integrating over the joint distribution. The variance is defined, similar to the way the autocorrelation is defined, the variance is defined as the signal minus its mean squared. Now, you're used to seeing things like autocorrelations and covariances in matrix form. We can write a matrix which represents the values of the correlation or the covariance over a set of lags. And if we do that, we can write a nice, simple linear algebra relationship between the covariance and the autocorrelation in terms of a product of the means. And we'll often make use of this when we're trying to derive properties of signals and random processes and such. Now, why do we typically work with the means and covariances so much in signal processing? And my pattern recognition students better know the answer to this question. So here we define the third moment. This is the covariance of essentially the third moment of the signal. So we have the expectation of X of L, X of M, and X of N. And here we have a similar thing for the covariance, for the correlation. So why don't you see this? Why don't you see the third moment as much as you see the first two moments in traditional linear signal processing? Because for Gaussian random variables, the higher order moments are all zero, third, fourth, fifth, and so on. You actually see these terms used when you're dealing with chaotic systems or nonlinear systems for which the higher order moments are not necessarily zero. But in most engineering applications, we approximate noise as Gaussian, and there's a reason for that based on principles of information theory. And in the process, the higher order moments for the Gaussian signals are zero, so we need not talk about them. So that's why for most linear signal processing applications where you're assuming Gaussian noise, you'll only see the mean and the covariance discussed extensively. Okay, so let's next talk about independence and stationarity. You all should be familiar with the concept of what it means to be a strictly stationary or wide sense stationary random process. So samples X of M and X of N are said to be statistically independent if the joint distribution for X of M and X of N can be factored into a product of the two marginal distributions. That essentially means these two variables don't share any information between them. The information about these random variables is entirely known from the marginals. This implies that the expectation of the product of these two signals can also be factored into the product of the expectations. And this also, and then X of M and X of N are said to be independent if their covariance is equal to zero. Now, so statistically independent means the joint distribution is factorable into two marginals. Statistically independent means the correlation between the two is zero. Now, in the real world, do you actually find situations where the random variables are completely uncorrelated? No. If I give you a data set and you compute this kind of a correlation, in the real world, it will rarely be identically zero. But often we'll approximate it that way because it makes the mathematics or the analysis much more tractable. Samples X of M and X of N are said to be orthogonal if the expectation of the product is equal to zero. A discrete random variable is said to be strictly stationary or strongly stationary if its kth order distribution function, and by that we mean the joint distribution between the xn1 through xnk, is shift invariant for any set of n1 through nk. Okay, that's the mathematical definition of stationarity. What does this mean in terms of practical issues? why is stationarity so important? Or give me an example of a variable which is not stationary. So suppose you are monitoring the most frequent words used on the internet. Okay, so you're constantly, Google does this in fact, every night Google takes all of its web pages and produces histograms of the most common single words, the most common word pairs, word triples, and so forth. And suppose you're watching this on a daily basis. Over the past few months, when would you have seen a big change in this? I'm trying to be culturally relevant here. Come on. What? The Olympics, exactly. Which started when? When did the Olympics start? 8/8/2008, right? This is a phenomenal date. You know, this doesn't happen that often. So that's a case of a non-stationary system, because on 8/8/2008, you will actually see this distribution changed. Now, the distribution won't change overnight. It actually changes dramatically starting about a few years ago. But the point is that that's an example of a non-stationary system if you're looking at these words as a probability distribution. An example of a stationary signal is something like Gaussian random noise. And why this is so important is because this means you can essentially take data from any point in time on the signal and estimate its parameters and know that those parameters will be roughly the same. You don't have to worry about when the data was actually taken. If, on the other hand, the system is non-stationary, like with the Olympics, you have to be able to adapt to these changes in the overall behavior. So there are search engines do this, of course. The search engines look at things that are most popular, things that are getting the most hits and such, and they track this kind of information, and there's a reason for that. Many reasons for that, actually, and those systems have to be able to adapt. So they have to balance the changes that happened in the past few days with the changes that have happened for all of time. Google has this massive database of all the web pages ever created, and they're constantly refreshing that so that when they compute statistics, the statistics are a balance between long-term behavior and recent behavior or short-term behavior. And that's an approach to dealing with non-stationary processes. When the system is stationary, we can write the correlation in terms of its lag. So this is a more familiar version of the correlation that you're used to seeing, where we have the expectation of x of n times x of n plus I. The autocorrelation is an even sequence, which means that whether you take x of n plus I, or x of n minus I, you get essentially the same result if you do that over an infinite extent. Another very important property of the autocorrelation function is that the expectation of x squared of n, essentially R0, is the largest value of the autocorrelation. This is related to a property called minimum phase, which we'll talk about in a moment. But this is another thing that makes autocorrelation functions very nice, is that the DC value, or the zeroth lag term, is the largest in terms of magnitude. The autocorrelation matrix, when formed from this operation, is a topless matrix and is positive semi-definite, which means simply that the projection of that matrix with any vector A, this projection will be greater than or equal to 0. You also know this notion in terms of the location of eigenvalues in the plane and such. So autocorrelation matrices are nice because they're very mathematically well behaved. Okay, good. That works, yeah. Now, there are, within these general properties, there are some important random signals. One of the most important is white noise, which we define as a zero means stationary discrete random variable, which satisfies the property that it's uncorrelated, so its joint distribution can be factored into a product of the individual distribution. And the autocorrelation value is zero for all values except when n is equal to m. So here we show that as sigma squared, which is the variance or the standard deviation squared of that random variable, times the delta function. And this delta function is only non-zero when n is equal to m. So white noise is a very useful abstraction because it's statistically very simple. What can we say about the frequency response of a signal which is composed of white noise? If you looked at the frequency response of a white noise signal in a spectrum analyzer, what would you expect to see? You'd expect to see a flat distribution, constant value for all of frequency. That's why we call it white noise, because like the analogy to white light, it contains all frequency components. Now, in practice, that's not feasible, but we can approximate that over a frequency range typically. So white noise is very simple because it's really just characterized by its uncorrelated property, and then all you really need to know is what its power or what its standard deviation or what its variance is. One parameter essentially describes all you need to know about the signal. And Gaussian white noise is even nicer because now, in addition to the basic white property, we have the Gaussian property, which says all you really need to know is its mean and its variance. Noise can be white but need not be Gaussian, and noise can be Gaussian but not white as well. But Gaussian white noise is by far the most common approximation and the simplest thing to deal with when you're doing adaptive signal processing. Another important concept that we will look at this semester is the notion of a Markov process. How many of you have been exposed somewhat to Markov processes? Yeah, that's going to be a problem. A Markov process is a process where the probability of a value of the signal given previous values of the signal is simply a function of the current value and the previous value. So it's essentially a first order Markov process is essentially a system or a signal which can be modeled by its previous value and its current value. All the information about the history of the signal is essentially encoded in the previous value. These are very powerful. It's a very powerful abstraction. A lot of signal processing is based on Markov processes. You might ask, well, what would a second order Markov process look like? Well, the dependency would be between xn minus 1 and also xn minus 2. Now, it turns out that you can implement higher order Markov processes as a series of first order Markov processes. So in some sense, there's no loss of generality here because we can implement higher order Markov processes using first order abstractions. And that's one of the reasons why you will see a lot of signal processing done with the first order Markovian assumption. Okay, a third type of random signal that we're very used to seeing is a Gaussian random signal. This is a signal whose amplitude distribution is distributed as a Gaussian distribution. What that means mathematically is that the amplitude distribution for a multi-dimensional Gaussian random signal or random variable can be written as there's a sort of a scale term and an exponential term. The exponential term is simply x minus mu times the inverse covariance matrix times x minus mu. X minus mu transpose C inverse x minus mu. This is what we call a quadratic form. This distribution is then scaled by the determinant of the covariance matrix and a scale factor related to the dimension L. So that when you integrate this function, it sums to 1, which is required for probability density function. Now, from this, we see that a Gaussian random variable is simply a function of its mean vector and its covariance matrix. And again, that's why Gaussians are so popular, because they're very simple. They're modeled in terms of its first two moments, mean and correlation or covariance. From an information theory standpoint, why are Gaussian distributions so interesting to us? Very good. The entropy, which we haven't really talked to reduce that term later, but entropy is a very, forgot to turn that off. Entropy is a very important term. Why? Classes like thermodynamics or other things. Why is entropy so important? What is entropy a measure of? The what? If entropy is high, what can you say? If entropy is low, let's say entropy is low. Right. So when we were trying to, was that a high entropy process or a low entropy process? The number of maximum number of metals would be 1-2 and have a pretty good chance of winning. You serve that variable is downer because it has the least constraints, just a mean and a covariance. So then one of the nice things about it, based on their entropy, from very or compression or coding, you learn that the entropy is related to the. So, for example, audio signals, you know, get on audio signals, the rate of compression you get on video signals, the rate of compression you get on other types of signals, but that all. Audio signals compress fairly well because they're not all that random. Component of the signal, it is predictable. So Gaussian random variables obviously play a very, very important role in engineering. In fact, Gaussian random variables and linear system theory are very much related, and we'll see that later in the semester. Finally, in terms of signals, I wanted to introduce the concept of a complex random signal. Thus far, we've been treating these amplitudes as real values. This amplitude be a complex number which has a real and imaginary part. Whether you treat a random variable as a complex number or as a two-dimensional level of variables are useful in a number of areas, such as communication theory, where you're dealing with modulation schemes that tend to be modeled as complex exponentials and such. Okay, so we talked a little bit about some of these. Sure. Is microphone stationary or non-stationary? Non-stationary. In my signals and systems class, I asked if real world systems were bounded or unbounded, and of course they will run out of energy and shut off. So we talked about the signals. Now we can talk a little bit about the frequency domain representation of the signal, and the primary way we view discrete time signals is through the Z transform of the correlation function. And we can obtain the power spectrum of that signal by substituting, actually converts a Z transform to a Fourier transform, discrete Fourier transform. White noise, again, has some very nice properties that if you take, we said that the correlation function for white noise was a delta function. So if you take the power spectrum, it's just going to be the, this R sub I should be gone here. That's just going to be, I was afraid that was going to happen. That's just going to be the sum of sigma squared delta sub I, which just gives you sigma squared. So here we show that the power spectrum of white noise is just a constant value related to its variance. For two random variables, we can define the cross correlation is simply the expectation of one of the signals, and the cross spectrum is just the Fourier transform of that. The cross spectrum has a nice property that the cross spectrum of XY is equal to the conjugate of the cross spectrum of YX. Cross correlation, why is cross correlation important? Give me an example of where you use the concept. Can I close this door? That's making a lot of racket out there. Yeah, I mean, that's a very sophisticated concept, but you're right. It's used extensively in matched filtering, optimal signal detection. Give me a more basic example. Suppose you're investing in the stock market, and suppose you're watching your investments over the past year. Why would you be interested in cross correlation? And cross correlation is related to a concept from information theory called mutual information. But why would you be interested in cross correlation? What's been the single biggest influence on the stock market over the past year? What? Don't say the Olympics. What has been influencing that? The price of oil, right? So what's if you're an investor, what's a question you're very interested in? How the price of your stock varies as a function of the price of oil. Because once you see oil going down, most likely your stock is going to go up and you want to start investing. So that's a simple way the cross correlation is used to understand the relationship between two variables, whether they're dependent, whether they're related or whether they're not, whether they're correlated as we say or not. So now I promised we're going to go through just about all of your undergraduate education in signal processing today. So now we'll move to the responses of linear systems. What is the definition of a linear system? And why are these so useful to us as engineers? Our systems, maybe let me step back from that and ask, are systems linear in real life? No. We would argue this microphone is a linear system when the battery's healthy. The louder I speak, the louder the signal gets. Of course, the battery adds a nonlinear element to the system. So what is the basic definition of a linear system, or what's a characteristic of a linear system? Right. If you double the size of the input, the size of the output should double. There should be a linear relationship between scaling of the input and scaling of the output. Very basic concept, but very, very important in engineering. We also can talk about linear shift invariant systems, and we characterize such systems with an impulse response, H of n. This is what you learn in your signals and systems class. And we can write that the output of a system, of a linear time invariant system with a given input is just a convolution between those two, and we can write a convolution sum for that output. So here we have the discrete time convolution between an input signal, the impulse response of the system, and that produces an output that's computed in this manner. We can note, because this is a linear system, we can note that the expected value of y of n Well, that's just the expected value of h of n convolved with x of n, and that's just the expected value of this convolution sum, but we can interchange the order of summation and expectation here, so we can write that this is the expectation of simply the impulse response times x of k, and this is equal to 0 if the input signal has zero mean. So the linear system not only preserves this amplitude relationship, but it also preserves some statistical properties, like if the input is zero mean, the output is zero mean. That's important, because if you apply, let's say, an audio signal to a microphone, you would hate to think if the audio signal is zero mean, which means it, you know, fluctuates around a value of zero, you'd hate to see the output have some enormous DC value associated with it. That would be a very bad thing. So this is sort of to be expected, but it's a nice property of linear systems. What are the tools, what are the primary tools that we use to deal with linear systems in the continuous domain? What are some of the mathematical abstractions you've used in your undergraduate education to deal with linear systems? If I give you a continuous time linear system and I ask you to compute the frequency response, what are you going to do? Fourier transform. If I ask you to compute the time domain response using a transform approach, what are you going to use? Laplace transform, right? So Laplace transforms, Fourier transforms are the primary tools that we use to analyze linear systems in the continuous time domain. In the discrete domain, what's the primary way that we analyze signals? T-transform, right? Now, I'm seeing some blank faces here. I hope that means you've not seen the Z-transform before. How many people have not? Well, I won't ask that. I'll just assume you've seen the Z-transform before. If you haven't seen the Z-transform, again, we can point you to some material you can read outside of class to catch up. But the Z-transform, you learn about this in signals and systems. You learn about this in digital signal processing. It's the primary way that we analyze discrete time systems. It's essentially a Laplace transform, just restated a little bit using a mapping. The Z-transform is nice because it makes discrete time systems look very similar to continuous time systems. The output, the Z-transform of the output of a linear system is just the product of the Z-transform of the impulse response times the Z-transform of the input signal, much like you'd see with Fourier or with Laplace. Now, an important consequence of this relationship and making use of our notion of correlation is the power spectrum. We can write that the power spectrum of the output, the autocorrelation of the output, RYY, is equal to the magnitude squared of the impulse of the Fourier transform of the impulse response times the autocorrelation of the input. Now, this expression is very, very, it says a lot. It's very significant. One of the important things you should observe about this expression, which this expression tells us how to compute the autocorrelation of the output given the autocorrelation of the input, you'll notice that the phase of the linear system, the phase of h of omega, does not influence this. Power tends to be blind to phase, and this is why in many signal processing applications, we never really talk about the phase of a system. We can also express this in the time domain. This is a lesser known property, that the cross correlation between the input and the output can be written as sort of a convolution sum of the cross correlation of the input times the impulse response. And that's, again, an important relationship. We will make use of this in some of our adaptive filtering algorithms, such as linear prediction, because this tells us that the correlation of the correlation structure of the output can be predicted from the correlation structure of the input and the correlation structure of the linear system. Okay, so let's sort of build on that concept and let's talk about models for random signals. Wolde's theorem, which is, you may not have heard it stated as that, but it's a theorem that's been around for many years, states that a stationary sequence X of n, which has no deterministic components, can be represented as the output of a stable causal shift invariant linear filter, H of n, with the white noise input. So what this says is that we can build a random signal out of white noise input with a linear system, convolved with a linear system. This is a very important theorem in the applications where you're trying to decompose signals, because it gives us a way to build arbitrary noise sequences or signals, random signals, out of white noise. So one way you can think about this is if you wanted to build a signal generator in MATLAB that produced random signals with prescribed frequency responses, all you need to do is take white noise input and apply a linear filter to it, and you'll get a signal which will have the spectral properties you want and the statistical properties you want. Now, we can build on that and introduce the concept of pole zero analysis. We can consider an important special class of linear systems as a class of systems which can be described as a ratio of two polynomials. Now, this does not describe all linear systems, but it can, well, I should say it does not describe all systems. There are some systems which cannot be decomposed as linear time invariant systems or ratios of polynomials. A phase lock loop is a good example of such a system. It's a very nonlinear system. But for linear systems, we like to do this because we can analyze the system in terms of the behavior of its zeros and of its poles. And by looking at the location of those poles in the z-plane, or if we were working in the Laplace transform for continuous signals, by looking at the pole locations in the Laplace domain, we can tell a lot about the signal. So there's three types of special cases of this that we will consider. The first and probably most popular for signal processing is the autoregressive model, which is simply an all-pole model, which means the numerator is 1, and all we really have is a denominator here. Synonymous with concepts like linear prediction, which we'll talk about later in the semester. Very, very powerful model, was revolutionized time series analysis in the 70s, even though it was first proposed back in the 1940s. A similar version to the all-pole model is the all-zero model, in which case the denominator is 1, and you just have a polynomial in the numerator. Where have you seen all zero models used? All zero models are synonymous with what types of digital filters? Okay, so you're going to go home and read your digital signal processing book tonight. Finite impulse response digital filters are essentially all zero models. So what properties of the model are you most concerned about? Well, certainly the frequency response. But you'll also be interested in phase, as we'll talk about in a moment. For such systems, we can write a discrete time output as the output of a linear constant coefficient difference equation. So these two relationships are essentially synonymous. If we were in the continuous domain, this would be the differential equation. This would be Laplace transform. In the Z domain, we have the Z transform and the time the difference equation. This is nice because it tells you in a very simple way how to compute y of n given a signal x of n. Just plug in the various values, compute the output as a weighted sum. We can talk about stability of the system. Under what conditions is this system stable? Well, what does stable mean? Well, stable means bounded. So under what conditions will the output of this system always be bounded? All the poles are inside the unit circle, right? So what does it mean? So for example, if the system is bounded, what's going to happen when I pound my fist on the table? Eventually the sound is going to die out. That's a good property, right? It would be really annoying if every time I did this, it got very, very loud. So this system will produce a bounded output for a bounded input if the poles of the system are inside the unit circle. Well, the poles are essentially found by looking at the roots of this polynomial in the denominator of the transfer function. That's why autoregressive modifications of this system determine the stability of the system. Minimum phase is sort of a related concept. This system is minimum phase under what condition? Minimum phase means it's maximally compact in time. We'll talk later in the semester about that, why that's so important. But essentially, it means that if you, autocorrelation functions are essentially minimum phase representations of signals because they throw away the phase. So minimum is traded around time equals zero as possible. It generally means a signal. Under what conditions is a signal minimum phase? Well, we have poles inside the unit circle, so surely someone must have thought about. So that's one that you should be familiar with. Of the system are inside the unit. That's why the unit circle in the Z transform becomes so important. Where the poles in the frequency response. And that's in the pattern recognition or treatment of this for the moment. But it talks specifically about means and variance. In pattern recognition, we deal with this, the properties of many of these well-known estimators. Intellectual tells you many of the things you've been doing for a long processing standpoint or from a statistical standpoint. But here we'll expectation of theta hat minus theta, and it actually has a lot of significance. It has something about what I call the graduate student nightmare. Last semester in pattern recognition, I talked a lot about the common pitfalls of graduate students, right? And what this tells you, why we view this statistically, is some chance you got it wrong. Estimators can be viewed as random processes. Sometimes you get close, sometimes you don't. The amount of bias averaged over all possible outcomes. And you'll hear a lot, this is one of my favorite things. If you average over all possible outcomes possible, you'd like the expected value of your estimate to be as close to the true value of the parameter. If, of course, this estimate is equal to theta, then the estimator is said to be unbiased. Now, think about that. That doesn't say that theta hat is equal to theta. That says that the expectation of theta hat, the expectation of all possible outcomes, is that means it's okay to get it wrong some of the times, but on the average, you want your estimator to be the average value of your estimator. Now, this is a nice property, but this isn't always possible, especially equation, is that the limit of the expectation of your estimate gets. One of the things, and that's often defined in terms of the variance of the estimates, at the deviation, the accuracy of a squared error of our estimate can be computed as the sum of errors. You'll see us talk a lot this semester about mean squared error estimate. We've moved beyond this and that makes a clear sensitivity. And the conditions under which this are true relate to some conditions under which this will be true. Now, a related concept to the sufficient statistic, but sufficient statistics essentially say that some transformation of data is considered to be a sufficient statistic if all the information about the parameter is contained in the estimate. Now, that's sort of intuitively easy to understand. What this means mathematically is a little more complicated, so I've included a reference to some pattern recognition notes on that that go into this topic in more detail. But the main point here is that if you're looking at something like estimating the mean of a Gaussian random variable, up the Gaussian random variable, you know, divide by n, well, that turns out is a sufficient statistic for a Gaussian random variable. And we can then take this a little further and talk about the estimation of time average from an ensemble. This normal way that you're used to computing the mean turns out to be an unbiased estimator of the mean. The process x of n is considered ergodic if the estimator is consistent, and we can write that as this estimate of the mean goes to the true value, then it's considered to be consistent. An unbiased estimator of the autocorrelation is this expression, which is x of n times a delayed version of x of n, but it's scaled by this term m minus the lag, and that's a little bit unusual, but this is actually the way you make the estimator unbiased. An alternate estimator that you may be more familiar with is to simply divide by m, and this is more useful for large values of m and small values of capital M, but this is the unbiased estimator. This has a bit of bias associated with it, but this is asymptotically unbiased, and that's why this is often used more. But if you've ever wondered where these crazy equations come for correlation, this is the main difference between these two. Now, later in the course, we'll explore more powerful ways to estimate these kinds of parameters, especially under the condition of limited amounts of data. But adaptive signal processing in general involves the trade-off between how you estimate parameters and the amount of data that you have. Estimate of the correlation, or update the estimate of the mean when you've observed a small number of new data points. And we'll cast all of that in a 70, 60, 75 minutes. It's go through like 4 or 5 courses. And obviously we did a very high level in the parameters of a model to better fit the current operating environment using a small number of data samples. And statistics to develop these techniques. And that's why we reviewed a lot, discussed how to analyze and model linear dominant type of system that we consider in this course, because they're the most tractable mathematically. But we'll actually talk about techniques which can be applied to estimation in a moment. Okay? And I will see you on Thursday, and we'll begin chapter 2 and go through that again pretty quickly, because that's largely